So you have no audience at all.
I could throw my voice.
No, you were a ventriloquist too. Yeah.
People we can pull up.
Okay, first matter on calendar this morning, 64122, Lanny versus State. Are you ready, Mr. Pauls?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay.
For the record, Your Honors, my name is Thomas Qualls. I am here representing the appellant, David Lanny. Good morning to each of you. We had, I wasn't there, but there was oral argument yesterday at the U.S. Supreme Court on this issue, and unfortunately I don't think we know anything more now than we did before, except for that that case may not actually go forward. What we do know is that the law is moving towards more protection for juveniles, with Roper, with Graham, and with Miller. My client, David Lanny, has spent the last 36 years in prison for a crime he committed when he was 16 years old.
But he is parole eligible now, right?
What's that?
He is parole eligible.
Pursuant to AB 267, yes.
So is that even an issue? It's a kind of a moot issue.
Well, the issue... Let me back up just for a second. The issue in Miller, and of course Mr. McCarthy and I have a difference of opinion on this, but the issue in Miller, in my opinion, is not the prohibition of mandatory juvenile life without sentences, as much as it is the underlying reasons for that, which a mandatory juvenile life without sentence prohibits the consideration of all the ways in which juveniles are different from adults. Of course, the court goes into some detail about that. All of the amicus briefs and whatnot, and Roper and Graham as well, talk about all of those differences. And so, to me, the essence of Miller is that it's the requirement which they set forth that sentencing courts consider these things in the context of juveniles. Essentially, they say, almost verbatim, what AB 267 says now, a court prospectively.
Let me ask you this, though. When they did the sentencing on this particular case, didn't they actually consider factors related to his age? And it was mentioned, I think, during the sentencing process.
Didn't they find it was a mitigating factor?
That's right.
Let me just clarify that, and I addressed this in my briefs, but that is the central issue here, and I think that's how this case differs from a lot of them that have considered it in post-Miller, and that's that Judge Breen stated on the record, your age is not a factor for consideration here. Your juvenile, the fact that you're a juvenile, will not have any bearing upon the sentencing in this case. He said it in two different ways, two different times on the record. That's how we know that. With regards to whether they considered his age, they only considered his age in the same exact context that they considered everybody else's age. You know, the oldest, Tom Wilson, was 20 years old. And so they make a note in the sentencing order in each of them, he's 16, he's 18, he's 20. There was no special consideration for him as a juvenile. There was some consideration for all of them, albeit very briefly, look, Your Honor, he's young. That was the extent of it. What we know now is far different, of course, than what we knew in 1979 about the juvenile brain, etc. But that brings about the decision. All that information that we know now brings about the decision in Miller and brings about the mandate of AB 267, and of course a lot of other states are following suit in the wake of Miller and enacting similar legislation.
What more can we do for him besides say he's eligible for parole? You want him to be resentenced? You want him to go back? Because this was an unconstitutional three-judge panel anyway that gave him life without. Let's say he gets life with. He's still eligible for parole either way.
Right. Well, here's I think, the critical piece of that is that he's done 36 years. He's also still got two consecutive sentences related to the robbery sitting out because he's never been able to parole to them, right? So AB 267 gives him credit for the 20 years. He's still got 16 years there wasted, right? If he gets a new sentencing, he goes back and he's sentenced under the sentencing laws existing in 1979, and as Mr. McCarthy and I both agree, he would, it's possible that he could get a sentence of life with, and it's a 10-year minimum in 1979, which means then he's done 26 more years without having any eligibility for parole. The only remedy that I can think of for that is to give him a new sentencing to be able to present these arguments along with all of the mitigation to the sentencing court and ask them to run, and this is what we can do, run the murder sentence concurrent to the pre-existing robbery sentences. Now, you can't go back and be resentenced on the robbery because that's not on the table right now, and I wanted to clarify that because Mr. McCarthy discussed that in the supplemental briefing. But what you can do is give the sentencing court would have discretion to run that murder sentence concurrent to the other sentences, and that would in some way remedy all of these extra years that he has spent. Now, I'm not saying that he is automatically going to get parole, but in our experience, and I've been before Your Honors in the Pardons Board a number of times, and heard from the representatives for NDOC that murder cases, generally, they'll give them a dump once, maybe twice. So they can, depending on what statutory scheme they're under, they get a 5-year or 10-year dump, they come back. But these people are not, for the most part, spending life in prison. His record is going to have to stand on its own, and we're not here for a sentencing hearing. But I believe under Miller, he's entitled to that consideration, and I believe what makes this case different is that we know the court didn't consider it because they said they wouldn't. And then the record certainly doesn't have anything of meaningful value related to his juvenile status. So that's the best remedy that I can think of, and I think it's appropriate for a new sentencing to allow him to be sentenced under the prior sentencing scheme and allow the judge to have the discretion. Of course, wouldn't be able to go over and above what AB 267 mandates, but that's the essence of that.
What a shame when he pled guilty to murder and the robberies. Is that correct?
He did.
What a shame that his attorney didn't consider that down the line that those consecutive sentences would be so devastating to his possible release someday from prison.
Well, his attorney did a number of very questionable things, and I realize that's not really the issue here. But he also waived any defect in the juvenile certification process, which could have been a factor in this as well. In essence, but for that error, the robbery may or may not be on the table.
What about the Pardons Board? Has there been any talk with him? I mean, it's a shame we have a Pardons Board November 16th, but the agenda's all set.
He discussed that with me. In light of this appeal, in light of his pending parole board application, I didn't think that was appropriate for us to move forward on that. I thought that would have confused the issue. I know from experience that one of the questions before the Pardons Board is, do you have any appeals pending?
Are both robberies consecutive to each other, or are they just consecutive?
It's just one robbery, but the robbery has a deadly weapon in hand.
One robbery and use of a deadly weapon.
Yes.
I don't know what to tell you on this. I don't know what my colleagues think. I just it makes it real tough for us. I mean, he's eligible for parole, and then, you know, hopefully the parole board would be very kind to him down the line on the robbery and use. But I don't know what we can do about the robbery and use. It's really not even before us. And to say to send him back for sentencing, I don't know if we can even do that. I'd like to be able to come up with a solution, but because of, you know, you go back to 1979, where there was no thought that that this country would consider helping out juveniles who committed murders and who got life without. It's a relatively new thing. I just read a book called Just Mercy, where there's Brian Stevenson, civil rights attorney, is going all over the country trying to get some of these kids out. There's hundreds of them in prison right now. And this is just an example of something else, a glitch in this whole thing with the life without. I don't know what my colleagues think. I don't know what to tell you.
I agree. And, you know, if you take Miller as being retroactive, and I understand that that's at issue, but the vast majority of the states, I think 10 to 4 or something right now, are saying that it's retroactive. I believe that it meets the retroactivity criteria as set forth in my brief. I believe that it creates a substantial change within the procedure that requires that. It does address a class of persons, juveniles, and it prohibits a certain punishment without these substantive considerations. I think that's a fair assessment under Teague and under the Nevada Supreme Court's prior retroactivity analyses to make it retroactive. Again, we'll see, and it'd be helpful if the Supreme Court would just say it up front. But
let me just ask you this. Even assuming we take Miller and say it's retroactive, and correct me, I may have incorrect view of these facts. My understanding was that Lanning was facing the death penalty. Is that correct or incorrect?
That is correct.
And doesn't that mandate that the panel specifically required the panel is required to consider his youth in that context? And you know, I had the impression that they, in fact, did when they repeatedly brought up his age and said he was young and immature, and he was talked into participating in the crime by others, and, in fact, found that to be a mitigating factor. He acted under the dominion, domination of his co-defendants. And so that's kind of where I'm getting stuck here.
Well, I'll tell you that another one of his co-defendants, who was 18 years old, the court found the exact same so-called mitigator, that he was under the dominion of Tom Wilson, who was a 20-year-old. That belies that there's any special consideration for him as a juvenile, as a 16-year-old, under the law. Again, stating each of their ages does not really distinguish David Lanny from any of the rest of the defendants who are 18 and older. There was not, and I would urge you to look at the record that I presented, there was simply not the consideration of his juvenile status on the record as required by Miller.
There was no discussion of him being young and immature.
Judge Green said unequivocally, we're not going to consider your juvenile status in sentencing. I think that, how does it get any more clear than that, than a judge stating on the record that he's not going to do what Miller requires him to do? I would love to reserve just a small portion of time for...
You've got about a minute and a half left.
Rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. McCarthy?
Good morning, Justices of the Supreme Court. I'm Terry McCarthy from the Washoe County DA's office. And there is something that ought to be corrected here. Mr. Qualls mentioned several times that Judge Green announced that there would be no consideration of the defendant's age. That's simply untrue. In taking the plea, the judge said, your age is not a binding factor at all in connection with the court of sentencing. That's all. So the suggestion that the court announced they would not give any consideration.
So that statement was not made at the sentencing hearing?
No. No, this is at taking
the plea. Was there any such statement similar to that made at the sentencing hearing?
I don't recall
by Judge Breen?
I don't recall one. This is the only one I recall, and this is the judge said when taking the plea, it's not a binding factor. Well, it isn't. Now, the...
I was going to ask you to begin with the first part, which is kind of the base, and that is, does this apply retroactively, or should it?
Well, there is the question of what is this, and whether it should apply retroactively. I have tried to make sense out of Miller as it applies in Nevada. And if it simply announced that you can't have a mandatory life without sentence, we don't. We didn't. If it is a rule of law that a sentencing body must consider all the mitigating evidence that's presented, we always have. At least when these murders were committed, the statute required consideration of any evidence presented, and specifically consideration of the defendant's youth as a mitigating factor, and the court did. If it is the only way I can see that it changed anything at all is if we are adopting the French system and making the court an investigative body and requiring that the court go out and find evidence, present it, and consider it. Because if it's something else, if it's the counsel must be allowed to present mitigating evidence, well, we've always had that too. And they did.
Is he eligible for parole?
He is.
He's eligible for parole. So whether Miller's retroactive or not, it really doesn't matter because of the statute.
That's correct. I don't.
So he's eligible for parole, and can't we do a disposition that says this matter's moot because he's eligible for parole, and then let Mr. Qualls worry about the parole board as to the robbery?
That's my recommendation. I don't think that there is a real dispute before the court. The legislature has stepped in, and I don't think there's any request for any greater remedy, or there isn't one that this court is empowered to grant. And so, in my opinion, it's moot. I don't see what else the court could do. It could order a new sentencing hearing, and by the terms of Miller, the court could consider and I suppose give life without once again, and consecutive terms once again. Whether the prisoner wants that, I don't know. I suspect not. I wouldn't want it. So anyway, that is my recommendation: is that the court just declare that the issue is moot, because he's got all the remedy from the legislature that he can get. Whether he might have gotten something different from the judicial branch, I don't know. But yes, if we go back to the petition and what he was claiming, he's got all the remedy to which he would be entitled.
Maybe he could try to withdraw his pleas to the robberies. Robbery in use. That's a possibility. Maybe some judge would be nice enough in Marshall to say, okay, we're going to allow you to withdraw your plea because you didn't know that someday you'd be eligible for parole. And you didn't care whether it was consecutive or not because you thought you were going to spend your whole life in prison.
Well,
could be.
If such a petition is filed, you may expect from me a motion to dismiss the since that would be the sixth petition. I suppose I could fashion an argument that it was procedurally barred in some way. But as it is, until that petition is filed,
it's just an idea.
Yeah.
Trying to make our job easy, too. You know, it's not only both of you, but
I understand
this is
that.
Very confusing to me, and it'd be interesting to see how the Supreme Court's going to handle the whole thing. They argued yesterday.
Well, the retroactivity is, I agree with Mr. Qualls. I'm not sure we're going to get a ruling. Although it's been my experience that the oral arguments at the U.S. Supreme Court don't have a whole lot of bearing on the decision of the court. But there are two approaches to the retroactivity. And all the cases that are in the system now, it's where there was an actual mandatory sentence. We didn't have one of those, and so I don't see how.
Why does it matter whether it's retroactive or not?
It doesn't. It doesn't to me. The only way it is there's an issue of retroactivity is if Miller changed something very specific in Nevada and required that not only the lawyers can present evidence, but if the lawyers fail to, the judge must go out and find it. That's the only way that there is some retroactive impact on Nevada, is to say that the judge must become an investigative agency. And I don't think that is what the court meant in Miller. I think they meant that a court must consider all the available mitigating evidence, and that's exactly what happened in this case. The court found the youth as a mitigating factor. You know, the suggestion that there must be additional evidence about the growing brain, and I am willing to wager every judge on that panel was once a child and has some experience with the notion that one matures over time. There's no reason at all why judges couldn't consider that without any evidence, just because they were themselves children. So I don't think that there is anything to be retroactive here. You know, the basic rule is courts must consider mitigating evidence. You know, the undeveloped brain is a mitigating factor. None of this is new. Perhaps the potential for rehab is new. But that's a social standard. It's not really a legal standard. So I suggest that there's nothing to be retroactive, nothing that has any effect on Nevada. We have not had any mandatory life sentences, life without, and we still don't. I think we had one for a short time. It had to do with abuse of a corpse or something.
For years, life without was not even life without in this, this jurisdiction.
True.
I represented Melvin Geary when he got life without, and then he got paroled and killed somebody else, and he got commuted and paroled, and he killed somebody else, got death, but he died of cancer.
I heard the second Geary appeal in post-conviction. Yeah. I recall the evidence that when he's not drunk and killing people, he was a wonderful fella.
He was a cook. He was a chef. A sous chef.
Yes. But we don't want to wander down memory lane here, Josh.
One of my major losses as a public defender, Melvin Geary. Tried it with a guy named Bill Maupin.
of my acquaintance also.
Yes.
Anyway, I'm sorry, Justice, did you have a question?
No, I just wanted to bring us back to the present.
Probably a good idea. I tend to wander. But I know you'll all be surprised to learn that I don't have a whole lot to add here. I think my position is clear enough that there is nothing that changed in Nevada with the Miller decision. If there was anything that changed, then this fellow has got all the remedy to which he's entitled. I recommend that the court just declare the issue moot, dismiss the appeal as moot.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, you got about a minute and a half.
I'll be very quick. I wanted to quote the exact statement from Judge Breen.
Is this at the time he's taking the plea?
This is at the taking of the plea.
Or is this at the time of sentence?
At the taking of the plea. But I think it's important. There are two statements. One of them was not properly reflected. And it says, your guilty plea to this charge removes any possibility of you applying for any kind of treatment as a juvenile as a result of this murder charge. I think that speaks for itself. And with regards to whether mitigating evidence...
But counsel, even with that, we in the record, it indicates it did find the youthfulness of the defendant a mitigating factor. So we have this after statement as to the sentencing.
We may have to agree to disagree about that, because I believe if you say the youth of the 16-year-old, the 18-year-old, and the 20-year-old in the exact same context and recite their ages in the exact same context, that does not meet the mandate of Miller. Miller says youth is more than a chronological fact, and it sets forth at least six factors: diminished culpability, potential for reform, lack of maturity, lack of a fully developed sense of responsibility, they're particularly vulnerable to negative influences. Now, that may or may not.
Some of those
but again, that last one is applied to the 16-year-old and to the 18-year-old. So there was no distinguishing between the juvenile. And the last one is that their criminal actions are less likely than those of adults to evince incorrigibility. And I would love to say one more thing.
Complete your thought there.
Thank you. I said this in my brief in response to Mr. McCarthy's statement, but we cannot assume that the judges considered things like the fact that they themselves had a childhood or anything else that doesn't appear in the record. We can't assume that they considered those things in considering and deciding this case.
All right. Thank you, counsel, both of you, for your good arguments here today. And the briefs were well done. We appreciate that. And so this matter will stand submitted.